think we're all shades of grey. You know, we can be loud and quiet, we can be shy, and we can be introverted and extroverted in different scenarios, and lots of other things too. And it's okay to be a real mixture.
That's Luke Tong, graphic designer and co-founder of Birmingham Design Festival. Luke's a self-confessed introvert, yet he's managed to co-create a festival that's changing the perception of Birmingham. That's no mean feat. In this episode, we chat about the importance of community, defining yourself, and how to be braver in your business. Enjoy. Welcome to Creative Slurp Podcast, giving you the juice to build a successful creative business with me, Victoria Brown, a creative business advisor, former jeweler and craft fanatic. Now you're in the right place if you want to find real talk, inspiration and the best tips and strategies for your handmade business without the overwhelm. We're all about making business exciting and fun. Now buckle up and let's get started. Hi, Luke. Thank you so much for coming on Creative Slurp Podcast. I was really excited to talk to you because you have really been on a mission, it seems, to promote design in Birmingham, which is, if anyone's not from the city like me, it's somewhere that is not known necessarily for its design prowess in its history, although it is known for its manufacturing prowess. And it seems to be a real kind of mission that you've taken on. So I really was excited to talk to you about all of that and about what you do. But before we get into that, Luke, can you tell us just a little bit about you and your business and what you do?
Yes. So good morning, Victoria. Thanks for having me. I'm having a big slurp of my drink, which is appropriate as we're talking. It's a real honour to be invited to talk to you today. So thank you very much for inviting me. And yes, I am excited to get onto the subject that you just mentioned. So I have had a bit of a circuitous route to where I am now. So I'm in my mid to late 30s. So I've been doing design all of my life, really. I am a solo agency. I'm an agency of one. A freelancer, I guess, although when people think of freelancers, they often think of people that go into other businesses to work for a time, and I don't really do that anymore. I have my own clients, but I'm a micro agency, is the nice way of putting it, and I kind of add people into that team as needed, but it's usually just me. But I also do a few other things on the side. So I'm a co-director of a company called Birmingham Design, which I guess we'll talk a bit about that, plus my own work, and I'll try and make clear the distinction between the two. And I do bits of lecturing and mentoring and other things as well. But yeah, the main things that I concern myself with now are Luke Tong Studio, which is me and my kind of private work, and then Birmingham Design, which is the umbrella company organization, which runs lots of other things in the city that you alluded to within the design space.
What's your specialism, if you like, within the design world and what you do? What's different about your work?
There's a big buzzword about finding your niche and niching. And, you know, I sometimes push back against that a little bit because I think that can confuse people, especially in the early stages of their career where they're worrying that they don't have their thing. But I've kind of realized I've gravitated towards two areas of practice really in my life. One is editorial design, so magazines, and the other is brand identity. So usually logos and logo systems, and then roll out of that work. They're the two kind of areas of design that excite me the most and I find most fulfilling and I think I'm best at. There are lots of things that I'm not good at, so I've quickly realized they're not my niche, they're not my specialty, and I would rather leave those to people who are good at those things and partner with people. But yeah, brand and editorial and print work stuff are really what excites me. I have kind of branched out beyond that a bit more recently. I seem to be doing more kind of outdoor advertising, guest campaign things, but still rooted in brand communications. And yeah, most of my bread and butter work is brand identity work for third sector clients, usually charities, healthcare, education, that kind of stuff.
It's so true that everybody is told to find this niche. And I think people panic a little bit, like you say, yeah, because they don't feel they've got it sorted out, and they feel that even though they've got loads of time, they feel like time's running out. How did you go about finding those things that really lit you up?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I maybe grew up or graduated, et cetera, in an era where it wasn't quite so hammered down your throat. Yeah, actually, the idea of being a generalist was looked upon very favorably. Certainly when I studied at university in Falmouth, they weren't trying to push us to be one thing. I think that the push was to be a problem solver and to have good ideas. And then you could apply those to lots of different scenarios. And certainly when you're starting out in agencies, you can't afford to say, sorry, I don't want to work on that. I only do brand work, or I only do print work, or I only do digital work. You know, so being versatile and adaptable is actually a really great thing to be. But I think the longer you do something, the more you realize what does light you up and excite you, and you know what you're excited to work on that day or that week. So it was a natural kind of thing. I was asked by a friend whether I would work on a magazine, having no real experience, just being a general designer. And I said yes, and I had a go, and I enjoyed it. And that led to me doing another one and another one. And the more you do that stuff, the more you kind of just fall into a pattern or a groove, I guess, a channel where you're happy in your lane. So that certainly happened with magazine work. And that kind of just bubbles along. And I do bits of, you know, maybe one or two different magazines a year. And then brand identity, I think I've always enjoyed branding. So that felt like a natural fit. And even when I was working in big agencies on very big campaigns, brand was really still at the heart of that. So I've just translated that or honed that, refined that skill a little bit. And kind of now I point it in a direction that interests me a bit more, which is, I wouldn't say purpose-driven brands, because I know that irks some people, but brands that are doing good in some way rather than just making people unhealthy or sad.
And how important is it, you know, the type of companies, the type of businesses that you work for and work with, how important is that to you?
Yeah, I think it's very important to me now. I think there is a time in your life where maybe you can't be as choosy. So I don't want to be too pious or, you know, look down my nose at anyone doing any kind of work. I think if you have the privilege to be in a position to choose, then it's really beholden on us as designers to work on things that we believe in or we are proud of or that we would stand behind. So I now am in a privileged position where I can be a little bit more choosy. So I do work with brands, organizations, and people specifically that I admire, and I, you know, I believe in their mission and what they're doing. And I want to give my time to them to improve what they're doing and feel like, you know, maybe it's not the most well-paid work, but it's certainly work that I'm proud of. And, I'm pleased is out there and I've improved something that matters. I had a bit of a realization when I was in my early 30s that I just spent a decade doing work that I wasn't very proud of. And although I'd learned a lot in that time, you know, it was mostly pizza boxes and beer cans and energy drinks and, you know, just things that, you know, were not making anyone's lives better particularly. I'm sure they were making a lot of people a lot of money, but I was starting to think about legacy at age 30, which is a little bit grandiose, but I was thinking, gosh, is this what I've got to show for myself? And so that really spurred me on to think I need to make some changes here. And even though I was doing work I was proud of on the side, I was aware that I was giving my best hours, my best energies to things that maybe were not the greatest things, and I could be channeling that energy into a slightly better area. So yeah, that was a real turning point for me in the last, I've been freelance or my own boss for 6.5, coming up for 7 years, I think now. And I've definitely, you know, the work I've done in the last decade has been very different to the work I did in the decade before, but I probably wouldn't be in the privileged position to be doing this work if I hadn't done that 10 years of training and growing and being refined. So yeah, it's funny how these things go and twists and turns, but I definitely think it matters what you do and what you turn your hand to. And if you have that privilege to be able to choose, then we should choose wisely.
Yeah, wise words. So you went self-employed 7 years ago. What was that like, jumping off the boat of safety and just flinging yourself out into the great unknown?
Very scary, but I think I'd waited longer than I maybe should have. And I can give a bit of context to that. I was working in an agency at the time where I'd been there for 7 years and I'd kind of risen as far as I was going to rise. And I was deeply unhappy. And I think the agency was deeply unhappy with me as well. So it was in that awkward situation of, if I don't leave now, I'm probably, you know, jump or be pushed situation. And for the last maybe 2 years there, I was pretty miserable. I was in a difficult situation with someone that was managing me that probably was dealing with their own issues. And it was just, it was an unstoppable force meeting an immovable object kind of a situation where it wasn't going to get any better, I'd realized. And so I was effectively being managed out of the business. And so jumping into the deep was, you know, scary, but also hugely liberating, because all of a sudden I didn't have that stress of these people are going to be on my back, or I'm not being very good at what I'm doing, or I'm not valued. All of a sudden, all of that pressure is on you. So you've got to decide whether you're doing a good job. And, you know, clients will tell you rather than a boss telling you. But I was ready. You know, I'd done 10 years of industry by that point. So I knew quite a lot. Obviously, there's a lot I still don't know. But I definitely felt like I was up for a change. And so it was both scary and very exciting.
How did you go about finding your first clients? Because I think that's something that daunts a lot of people.
Yeah, it is. And rightly so, really, because you want some degree of pipeline. Otherwise, you have no idea whether you're going to be able to get work. And lots of people go freelance at lots of different stages. And it's a really great thing to be able to do. But you don't often hear people talking about that kind of pipeline of new business and how you're going to find work. You just presume that it's going to be there because it's always been there when you've been in an agency. Someone gives you a brief and off you go. But you end up having to spend quite a lot of your time doing the admin. And that can be chasing work, or it can be, you know, just dealing with the clients. But for me, I was really fortunate. I built up quite a big network. I think that first year, all of the work that I did was from pre-existing relationships that I'd made in my 10 years in industry. So there were lots of people that had left work before me and had set up their own agency or were doing their own thing, had gone client side, whatever, and they needed someone. And it's always easy to work with someone that you've worked with before. So I was fortunate that I had those relationships. To be honest, none of them really lasted beyond that first year. So that was a real springboard into then finding my own clients. But by then I was starting to be a little bit more established as a, you know, as a solo outfit, and work started coming to me a bit more organically. And I was probably, you know, continuing to network and put myself out there as being available. But yeah, definitely scary. I remember part of the reason why I quit when I did was I had a big project that was lined up, that was a big chunk of money. And then that project disappeared after I'd quit. It vanished from the horizon because of, you know, someone changed job position, and that piece of work, it was a magazine, in fact, disappeared. So that degree of stability was gone, but actually it was in the right place at the right time because that helped me to leave. And then when it went, I didn't really need it in the end. I think I made the same in the first year freelancing as I did the year before when I was in an agency. And that was all I could hope for, really. Was very fortunate that things carried on a bit of an even keel. So yeah, it maybe doesn't work that way for everyone, but I think if you overstay your welcome like I did, and you've got 10 years plus experience, you should be okay, because you should have a degree of reputation by then, connections.
And how about somebody that maybe doesn't have that 10 years experience, or doesn't really have any work in the pipeline? I mean, what would be the best way to find new clients, would you say?
Oh, it's a great question, and it's a really difficult one to give an answer to, because so many variables. I think there are loads of things that you can do to position yourself for success, and they're things that are within your control. So you can be very visible online, which is, you know, the digital marketplace where people look for other people nowadays. So having accessible socials, being visible where people are looking for work, having a decent LinkedIn and a portfolio website and a PDF that you can send people and all of that stuff, you're in control of that. So you can set yourself up to be findable and hireable and friendly. You should probably speak to other people that have done it before and see what works for them, and figure out also what you're good at and where those clients may be that you would ideally want to work for. Maybe, you know, you don't get to choose when you're starting out, but if there is a bit of a niche or an area that you're interested in. And then I would always recommend people getting off the computer and getting out there into the real world and meeting people, being at events, old-fashioned networking, shaking hands and pressing the flesh, putting business cards in hands. And that kind of stuff does still work and is really powerful. If you meet someone in real life, that connection tends to go a lot deeper than just a click. So I think being visible and being accessible and being hireable and, you know, being open about what you charge and what managing people's expectations of you, what you can do, being really honest, I think all positions you really well. And then putting the word out, you know, speaking to other people that maybe are still employed or that run their own businesses, and just being proactive, reaching out to people and saying, you may not need me right now, but this is what I do and I'd love to work with you. Please think of me. I think you have to treat finding work as a bit of a job rather than just, and I say that to anyone that's, you know, new designers entering industry, jobs don't really fall in your lap. You have to go out there and create those opportunities. And I think that's true of freelance as well as it is finding your first kind of agency jobs.
I think that's really good advice. And I think it's also good advice, not just for designers, but for anybody in that freelance sphere, anyone that's got a small business, really.
Yeah, I think so. There's such an influx of people doing that now, which is great. And, you know, thank goodness that things have been democratized so that, you know, anyone can start a business, become a designer, etc. But it does mean that the competition is pretty fierce and there's lots of people all vying for the same opportunities. So while there are plenty of opportunities, you do have to go fishing for them. They won't just kind of jump into your lap normally.
Do you think that competition has got stiffer since the pandemic and since people have been walking from home more?
That's a good question. I think lots of things have changed. I don't know about competition. Maybe it's difficult from my vantage point because I'm in a degree of a niche and I work with in like specific sectors. So I wouldn't like to say across the board. Mm. I think there are always more and more people going freelance at a younger age. That's one thing that has changed dramatically over the last 10 years or so. People leaving uni and just launching straight out into the world of freelance rather than learning the ropes somewhere else. So I think that's interesting because that suddenly imbalances things a little bit and that just changes the nature of things. People are maybe offering their prices cheaper because they're younger, etc. And I think, working from home has definitely changed things. Weirdly, it's all of the other things that's affected more. So people attending events, people getting out into co-working spaces, or all of those kind of things have definitely changed. And I guess people also have a bit more time on their hands in some respects, because if they're not doing a commute for 2 hours a day, they may be spending that time working, or that, you know, working patterns have changed for sure. So, I think some of that's good and some of that's challenging. The freelance landscape is an ever-changing sea of murkiness and interest. So it's never a stable thing for sure.
It really is. So design then, what is it about design that lights you up? And is it something that you always have been interested in from an early age? Can you remember any specific memories where design really, you know, you just thought, yes, design is for me?
Yeah, I think I can. And I probably didn't know it was design at the time, but I grew up in a relatively creative household where dad was often in a shed making things and we were encouraged to do that. And mum was baking or something, you know, very gender stereotypical. But there was always kind of craft and art was around. I was drawing Asterix comics and Beano and Dandy comic strips and things from a young age and quickly realised that decorating my work was more interesting than doing the work. So that was always feedback I got at primary school. Was like, if Luke spent as long on his writing as he did on his illustrated borders. So I think it was clear to me that design stroke art was what I was good at and the only thing that really interested me. My dad used to collect National Geographic and Time magazine and things like that. And I was very aware of the kind of visual, now brand language stuff, but those iconic yellow borders and red borders on magazines and things. I was noticing that stuff probably earlier than my peers were, and I was interested in that stuff. So from an early age, that was what I wanted to do. And then as a teenager in the 90s and into the noughties, visual culture was exciting and dynamic, and there was lots of, you know, really interesting brave work happening in advertising and print, and the YBAs, the Young British Artists, were a thing. It just felt like a really exciting time within that kind of visual culture. I was getting into skating and BMXing and punk music and alternative stuff, and again that was very visually led and very exciting, and it, you know, you kind of find your tribe within that space and identify with that stuff. So I was heavily into that. And I was just always excited by visual culture. I was always interested, you know, if I went to the cinema and there was a stand with postcards in, I'd spend a long time choosing which postcards I wanted to take home and decorate my door with stickers and covering my folders and all of those things that I guess lots of kids do, but probably you identify as someone that's, you know, a bit of an arty nerd. So that was me. And then that just continued, just the love of design and creativity in all its forms, really.
Was a creative career something that you were encouraged in? Because I know some people are kind of discouraged away from the creative careers because it's too risky.
Yeah, I was really fortunate. Again, my parents were very open to that. My dad was a GP, so, you know, it couldn't be further really from what he was doing. He never imposed that on me or my brother or sister. And we've all had very different careers. My sister was very bright and studied law at Cambridge, which was never, you know, going to be the sort of thing that I was going to do. And I just naturally, I was the baby, the youngest child. I just fell into arts being what I was good at and wanted to do, and they just really supported that. And I think at the time I was never really conscious of what the careers might be at the end of it. I mean, for a time I wanted to design rollerblades, and then I wanted to design gardens, and then I wanted to design shoes, and then I wanted to be a photographer, and then, you know, it chopped and changed. But at the heart of it was visual communication, and I realized that design was probably the best outlet for that, graphic design specifically. I wasn't particularly scientifically minded, so graphics was just very visually immediate and very tactile and very exciting. And once you realize you've got an aptitude for that, it's very addictive. You want to do more of it. And, you know, I found it very compelling and very exciting. And that stayed with me.
So why Birmingham Design then? So you set up this amazing organization to champion design in Birmingham. As I mentioned, not the city that was necessarily known for being a design-led city. What led you to take that on? I'm always fascinated by people taking on these big challenges to kind of change people's mindsets. Are you from Birmingham originally?
No, I'm not. I'm from Nottinghamshire originally. I married into the Midlands in 2009. So I've been here 14 years. So it feels like home now, very much so. And I think Birmingham's very good at welcoming incomers like myself. And I really was excited when, you know, I grew up in a small village. My first job was in Mansfield, which is not a hugely glamorous town, city. And then moving here, I was really excited by the opportunity. You know, you think second city, it's going to have amazing everything. I used to have to travel hours to get to a cinema or a magazine shop. But, you know, growing up in proper rural back and beyond. And then I realized that actually there's a load of great people here, but not necessarily a very connected. They didn't seem to be a hugely open and visible and connected community. Well, lots of pockets of amazing people, but there didn't seem to be this infrastructure. There were lots of great people doing great things, but it just seemed, for the second city in the country, it seemed to be lacking what I had noticed was happening in other places. And that, as a designer, is a really interesting thing, because you're always looking for a gap in the market or an opportunity. You can work with that. And I felt like lots of my friends had gone to London and done that thing and been a smaller fish in a bigger pond. I quite liked the idea of being somewhere that I could make an effect change. And community has always been really important to me. So you gravitate towards other people who are doing things. And the story of Birmingham Design now is that my friend Dan Alcorn, who is co-director in everything that we do, he was busy with a community event called Bad Ego, which other friends of ours had started and he'd taken over. And that was a meetup that happened regularly for designers in the city. And I met him through that and spoke at one of their events and just got involved. And he approached me and said, I'm thinking of doing a festival. I think Birmingham deserves a festival for design. Are you up for partnering with me? And I just said, yes, let's do it. And long story short, we delivered a festival the following year in 2017, built a team that has chopped and changed over the years, but has mostly stayed with us. And we've done three of those big festivals, plus 2 years of COVID disruption in the middle. So we're kind of 5 years into that journey. But it was really a load of things that aligned. Dan and I have very different skill sets. He's very digitally minded and brilliant at lots of technical things that I am useless at. And I've got good connections and I've got brand and print experience. So those two things together mean that we've quite a formidable partnership. We've both got a real heart for the city and the community and wanting to do things in a very accessible and inclusive and representative way, because that stuff's important to us. But we also have this thing about excellence and doing things really well. You know, Birmingham is a world-class city. There's amazing people here doing amazing things. That deserves a proper thing. Whatever you're doing, I feel like it deserves to be good and sustainable and long-term and for the community, not just to make money and disappear. So our aims were very aligned. There was this kind of festival-shaped hole. No one was doing it at the time, so there was an opportunity there. So we just thought, well, let's just give it a go and see what happens. And we quickly realized that it's a huge undertaking and it's a lot of work, but it's really enjoyable and rewarding. Now it probably takes up 50% of my time most of the year unpaid. So it's a big, you know, it's a huge thing that's kind of grown and grown. Dan is full-time employed, so he fits his kind of huge workload in around his job, which is amazing. He's got a family as well, so even more to kind of juggle there. But we make it work because we love it. It pays back in other ways, and we get to meet our heroes and deliver something which is, you said it before, changing the perception of Birmingham. And as an incomer, you know, I'm fascinated by this story of the city and the trades and the craft that has happened here. You know, I'm speaking to you from the jewellery quarter. There is such deep heritage and skill and pride in work in Birmingham. And that's changed over the years. And, you know, it was automotive for a time. It's been heavy manufacturing. And I live in the Black Country. You know, there's lots of story there of heritage and work. But now it's, you know, it's got a world-class design scene as well. There's some incredible people doing great work here. It's just never given the same prominence or chance as some of the other big cities because it's Birmingham. And it's, you know, too often been the butt of the joke or the, you know, the easy to poke fun at it for whatever reason. And I think Brummie's self-deprecation and humility has been mistaken for, I don't know, stupidity or whatever. And it never was that, and it never is that. And it deserves to be seen as the powerhouse that it is. So I'm very proud to be part of that movement of people within our little niche doing a bit of that perception change that's happening across the arts and food and music and other sectors as well. So it feels like a really exciting time to be part of Birmingham.
Yeah, there really is a lot of perception change going on. We've got Joe Lycett filming his live Friday night show from there, and also a very prominent Brummie who's proud to be a Brummie, because I think that's what's been lacking as well. There have been people from the city who have gone on to be famous and well known, but they've almost disassociated themselves from the city and not been proud of it. And now we've got people that, you know, like Joe Lycett, Alison Hammond, whoever, who are proud to be Brummies and are very, very prominent in the public eye. And that's got to be making a difference as well.
I think it is. And I think it goes hand in hand really with the city itself, like the infrastructure. And it's easy to be proud of somewhere when there are things to be proud of that are visible and that people can point to and say, oh yeah, like I get why. It's not just about the exports. It's, you know, lots of cities have had famous people from there that have left and live elsewhere. It's when you've got stuff that's happening, either stuff that's happening on a regular basis or visible change, which it makes it feel like an exciting, dynamic, safe, fun, vibrant place to be. And I think Birmingham's infrastructure has lagged behind some of those other cities. You know, we're finally sorting the tram situation out 20 years after other cities got their act together with that stuff. And we're finally, I mean, there's lots of views on buildings being demolished and replaced, but there's been a huge big city plan in Birmingham, which is this massive infrastructure building project of 20 years, very ambitious. And we're partway through that. And we're starting to see the benefits of that you could put an event on like the Commonwealth Games last year and it be in the city centre, much of it, and it look amazing. And people be really proud of sharing that space with the world. That wasn't the case when I arrived in Brum, and it was, you know, much greyer and more concretey, and you could understand why people perhaps a bit more would distance themselves, whereas actually bringing eyeballs back into the city and showing off the city and people experiencing it is a very different thing now. You know, you get off the train in Grand Central and it's completely different to what it used to be, and you walk through the city and bits of Digbeth are changing and the JQ, and there are genuinely exciting things happening here. And I think there's still loads to do and there's lots that's still lagging behind, unfortunately, but that change is happening. And I can see why, you know, it's easy now for people like Joe to be shining a spotlight, not on himself, but on Birmingham and celebrating Brumminess. And I think that's a really good thing. And we need more of that, because that's what the average person sees when they're in London or in Manchester or anywhere in the UK. And that must be slowly changing perceptions across the board, I hope.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with all of that. And your design festival then, that's been going on since 2017, is there one standout moment from it that it makes you just really proud and really excited and happy and all those things?
I'd love to say yes. I think there are so many moments. A project, and we think of it kind of as a project, doing something like the festival is a huge project. It takes a year to plan and deliver. There are huge aspects to that, so the branding, to the promotion, to, you know, the printed programs, merchandise, volunteers, speakers, then the event itself and capturing that and sharing that. And there are many different successes along the way that no one really sees. There's the team coming together and there's the volunteers stepping up and doing a great job, and there are people that are finding work through it. Or I think really the bits that Dan and I revel in the most is the feedback that we get, where people will quietly just send us an email and say, that talk changed my life, I quit my job and now I'm doing this, or that made me rethink everything that I thought about. And those bits of genuine feedback that are not like the big bombastic celebratory things, they're just genuine change in people's lives, is really staggering that you can be part of something that delivers that. And you know, to us, we just wanted to do an event and get our design heroes here and put something on that was fun. But some of those changes, and then the broader perception change, you know, we travel a lot doing talks in other cities and talking to people about their events, and people will now say to us, oh yeah, but there's an amazing scene in Birmingham. And that, even just to hear that from an outside perspective, is incredible, because that wasn't what was said 10 years ago. And so I think we have been part of that change. So that makes me very proud. There are obvious things like some of my favorite designers coming to Birmingham to speak about their work and now being friends with them. It's hard to make an equivalency of that to, you know, if you're a football player hanging out with the England team, or if you're a pop fan hanging out with all of the famous pop stars. It's very accessible and different within design, because they're just regular people. They're not, hopefully they're not these big kind of inflated egos, but there is something really lovely about meeting your heroes and then them turning out to be really nice people and getting to be friends with them. And so that's been a bit of a side benefit as well. But it's always the people stuff that is the most rewarding for me. It's those personal stories and the personal relationships that we've made through doing it. Though, yeah, massively satisfying to look back on.
Yeah, I get that, because a huge driver for me over the years has been helping people, you know, live the life they enjoy and run a business that they enjoy doing rather than something they hate doing every day. Yeah. That's why I started my blog a few years ago. I started a blog to promote jewelers, because I wanted just to tell people about these amazing people that were doing this amazing work that nobody knew about. And it's amazing how it can make you feel really, really good about it. And that's not, yeah, I just felt like it needed to be done.
Absolutely. And it's, I know it's corny, but that whole thing of it's better to give than receive is so true, because you get the satisfaction of knowing that you've done something good. And the other person that you're doing that thing for is, you know, blessed, encouraged, satisfied, overjoyed, whatever. It's a win-win virtuous circle thing. And the more you do it, the more you enjoy it and you want to do it. And so for us, finding ways that we can help people through big or small, through the work that we do, is really why we do it and where the joy and the motivation comes from. And we do that in lots of different ways that people don't always see. So the magazine that just arrived, we profile people in that maybe wouldn't be covered in the press normally. We run mentoring schemes every year. We have a scheme that's for young practitioners who maybe need another kind of further push. There are lots of things that we do that are, you know, relatively easy for us to do now. We've got the platform and the infrastructure, but they can genuinely make little changes in lots of people's lives and days. And that stuff is really rewarding. And I would have loved that if there were people around me that had been doing that when I was, you know, a young graduating designer. And I'm sure there were some people that were helpful, but to have found a community to be able to do that stuff in is just, yeah, really heartwarming, lovely, joyful stuff.
And I'm sure so many people listening to this will be inspired. Maybe they don't live in Birmingham. Maybe they live somewhere else and they're thinking that they need to promote designers or something else in their area. You know, how would they go about doing that?
It's tough. We find it difficult and we're in the second city. So I think harnessing people's energy, getting people excited about things, using the tools that you've got access to and the platforms, and going where people are, finding like-minded souls to do this stuff with. Yeah, putting yourself out there is always difficult. A lot of this stuff is long game. There's no kind of quick rewards or ROI that you can point to and be like, oh yeah, that delivered this much sales or this many new clients. But I think doing the right thing, helping people, is always rewarding. There's, you know, there's joy in doing that anyway, but that stuff always pays off in the long run. It's a relatively small industry, design, and lots of other industries I think are like this. Lots of people know lots of people, and your reputation is really important, and maintaining that and being known as someone who's helpful or useful and kind is only a good thing. So it all benefits you in the end, but it definitely requires a degree of sacrifice and vision to, you know, any endeavor, your podcast, you know, it takes time and energy and effort, but it will pay off and have paid off and continue to pay off in lots of other ways that maybe it never delivers, you know, any balance on your budgets, but it will deliver lots of other things, hopefully, and then therefore is worth doing. And, you know, that's what you hope other people can see and can join you in doing.
Yeah. So we hear a lot about imposter syndrome, etc. And did you ever think, you know, when we're thinking about this idea about starting Birmingham Design, did you ever think, oh, I'm not good enough, or I don't think I can be the one to do it, or did that just never enter your head?
I'm delighted to say I always feel like that, and I feel like that today. I feel like that, should I even be on this podcast? You know, every...
So do I.
Yeah, and I think that's a really healthy thing. I think I would always much rather lean heavily into humility and lack of confidence. For, you know, I think it's a funny thing, because I think confidence is really important, and we have to, you know, there's a degree of confidence in you running a podcast, there's a degree of confidence in me coming on here and thinking I've got something to say. But confidence is a very funny thing, and it can so easily tip into arrogance. And that is such a turn off to me and such a no-no in business, that I would rather have checks and balances and things in place to remind me of the humility that is required to do a good job, to serve people. And that's really what we're doing through much of our work, is serving people and serving a community that is very much not about building a platform for ourselves. It's about helping other people in whatever way we can. And, you know, we benefit from that. So I think imposter syndrome is a really tricky thing, because you don't really ever want to fully get rid of it. I think that little voice of doubt can be a really helpful thing, so long as it isn't crippling or stopping you from doing things. So I think there's a degree of balance to be found there. And we all live within the tension of lots of different aspects of our lives, you know, and I think that for me is one of them. It means that you're always pleasantly surprised when things go well. You're not just expecting that to happen. And, you know, I'm a firm believer in hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. You know, sometimes bad stuff does happen, but don't presume it's going to happen. Be optimistic, but also don't just presume that everything's going to be plain sailing. And that can be really helpful in business, you know, having a backup fund, not having one single client, but spreading that risk across lots of different things, having multiple irons in the fire in terms of what you do. I'm a bit worried about the future of my industry because of AI and all of the changes that are coming around automation. I can see in 10 or 20 years, I might not have a job as I know it. I may have had to pivot to do other things, but fortunately, I don't think AI is ever really going to take events away, because we're always going to be humans craving some sort of human interaction and community. So I can see a time where maybe I will pivot even more into that stuff and do less of the design. I don't know. I don't want that to be the case, but I'm aware that there are things that could change. Industry changes all the time. So yeah, I think a bit of imposter syndrome is probably a healthy thing. Too much is obviously a bad thing. And we need, especially young designers, especially women in design, need an injection of confidence and self-worth and to value their time and their passion and their energies. I think sometimes that can really be squeezed out of you through education, unfortunately. And there's a lot of work to be done there. And that's why I think mentoring and championing young people and helping people into industry is a really important thing to do, because a lot of people don't know how they should value their time and their output and their skill and their craft. And they give it away too cheaply, or they leave industry altogether because they haven't realized that they've got something worth giving. There's a lot of work being done there by a lot of people smarter and better than me. But that's something which takes up a lot of my time and thought as well, because I see that imposter syndrome in people a lot.
It is, like you say, we do need it, because if we're ever going to do anything exciting or grow, we need to get out of that comfort zone a little bit, and then we get the imposter syndrome, don't we?
Absolutely. That stretch zone where just outside of your comfort zone is where the most exciting and good things happen, I think. And I don't know, I like to play it safe too sometimes and just do things that I'm good at and, you know, say comfortable things. But that stuff, fair heart, never won, fair lady, idea of you've got to take some risk, and that's where the biggest reward lies. I know there's enormous privilege to being able to do that, if that's financial risk, or, you know, sometimes not everyone has that opportunity, but where you can, just pushing yourself and trying new things, I think everyone can do that. That's quite exciting, because you can often discover, you know, I'm a very shy person, or I used to be. I'm now a recovering shy person and an introvert. But I also get enormous joy from being with people for a time and doing things in community. I've realized that I can be a shy introvert and be on stage introducing things or hosting things. And I would never have dreamed that that was something that I could do. But I've practiced and done enough of it now that I know I will survive and not die entirely in that situation. But if someone hadn't given me the chance or encouraged me to do that, I maybe never would have done half of the things that I've done today that bring me joy, because that would have held me back. And again, that ties into that imposter syndrome a bit of I could never do that. That could never be me. And actually, a lot of people, I think, need to be told it could be you. or you could be doing something that you're not doing now, but it will require bravery and risk, and you may fail, and you may, and that's okay. Actually, don't see that as a bad thing. It's not failure if it doesn't go well. It's a success that you tried, and you'll be one step nearer to it happening in future. And if you want to overcome some of those obstacles, some of them are overcomable. And I'm a good example of that, but I never thought I would be doing most of what I do now on a daily basis, because I didn't think that was me.
Mm, that's amazing, because people, I think society does try and put us into boxes. So if we identify as being introverted, which I'm also introverted, it's like, okay, well, oh, I can't do that. And you automatically think you can't. And actually you can, because I used to work on stage, and people meet me and think I must be an extrovert. I'm really not at all. Yeah. I much prefer my own company, and I have to, like, you know, if I'm out at parties, I need to kind of psych myself up sometimes. Yeah. But yeah, it is like society tries to put us in these little boxes, and then people don't realize that they can.
No, absolutely. And, you know, labels can be really helpful when people maybe get a diagnosis or whatever that is, but actually not allowing that label to define what you can and can't do is really important. And, you know, you can be a shy person and be a shy person all your life, but still do things that are exciting and fulfilling and brave. Equally, you don't have to. There's no pressure to, you know, not everyone is meant to be doing what everyone else is doing. There's a place and a role for everyone, regardless of how you are. I think it's that idea of always being stationary, though, that you can never change, or that you are, you've got to sit within the confines of this box. And I think we're all shades of grey. You know, we can be loud and quiet, we can be shy, and, you know, we can be introverted and extroverted in different scenarios, and lots of other things too. And it's okay to be a real mixture, and, you know, lots of different things, not just one thing. And I think that's important to remember. I have to remind myself of that when I put myself in a box sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's really tempting. And I find I have little times of the month or whatever days when I'm really brave, and then other days when I'm really not. So when I am feeling brave, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to send that email, or I'm just going to do this. And I try to identify it now, because I know that I'm not going to feel like that all the time.
I was just going to say the email thing for me is a big one, that when you're your own boss, the fear of the email, like the feedback from the client or the next thing, or the rounds of amends. There are some days where I'm just like, oh, do you know what? I really don't, I can't even bring myself to click to open that email. And then I'll be like, what are you doing? Like, it's just an email. What's the worst that's going to happen? Which is mad, because then the following day I might be hosting something on stage in front of 300 people, which on paper should be way scarier for me, but sometimes isn't. And it's funny how those little quirks and things can just, you have to try and psych yourself up sometimes for these things. Yeah. And also knowing yourself, I think, is really important. Like, knowing that it, you know, maybe you don't work best at a certain time of day or certain time of the month, you need different priorities shift, and you need to prioritize a bit of self-care, right? I'm a big believer in that. But if you're your own boss and you're fortunate enough to do that, then really take charge of your own schedule. And I love film. I'm a big cinema goer. So I often take myself off to the cinema in the day for a quick lie down and 2 hours of mind rest, where I can just lose myself in a film, because I can do that now. Like, I'm in a position where I can do that. I've got access, I've got means, I've got the time. Why shouldn't I? I'll probably then work into the evening. And that's a decision that I've made. And that, you know, that's a lifestyle choice. I'm not saying that should work for anyone, but just that idea of you can do that if you want, like, you're allowed to do that. When you're a grown up, no one's telling you, we shouldn't be peer pressuring people into, like, you must sit at your desk 9 till 6 and then have, you know, look at another screen while you're watching the other screen, while you're thinking about the other screen. It's okay to, you know, switch things up a bit and do what you want to do. Yeah,
it feels like such a luxury, doesn't it, when you do things like that, and you feel a little bit naughty.
Absolutely. And I think we've all got slightly odd British hang-ups about work and relationships with work. And I know it's even worse in other countries when you look at, you know, how much holiday America gives their workers versus what we do. But then you look at other countries in, you know, Scandinavians, the happiness index of other places and their relationship with work, and you realize that we've really still got a lot to do in this country on that stuff. And, you know, people's self-worth tied to their productivity, all of that stuff is, you know, a really dangerous place to be, because work is just something that we do. It's not who we are. And that can be really hard for creatively, vocationally led people who believe that, you know, I'm a designer, that's my vocation, that's all I've ever wanted to do and be. But if I lost the use of my hands, hopefully I would continue to exist as a person and have something to offer the world and be able to do other things. We really tie ourselves to our output and our productivity sometimes. And I think it's important for people to remember they're much more than just what they do.
Definitely. And that's very, very wise words. Thank you. Thank you, Luke.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I think you've just been, you know, really inspirational, really, about what you're creating and what you're doing with Dan, and, you know, how you could just take the easy route and sit there and do your design work, but you're pushing for more. And I think that's always, you know, amazing to see someone do. So
thank you.
Well done.
Selfishly, that balance is really enjoyable. You know, I would get bored if I was just doing one thing all day, and being able to mix things up a bit is very rewarding as well.
So if people want to get in touch with you, find out more about Birmingham Design and what you do, where can they find you?
Great question. All over the place. So anywhere where you would find anyone, pretty much on the socials. I'm at Luke Tong, and luketong.com is my website, which has more than you would ever want to know about me on. So I'm sure people could have a look there and find things. And BDF, the festival, and Birmingham Design also have social channels and websites. If you search bdf.events, you will find festival website. And if you Google Birmingham Design or go to birminghamdesign.co.uk, you'll find all of the things that we're doing kind of community-wise. I would encourage people to do that. We have lots of people from all walks of life within the creative sphere. You don't have to be a graphic designer to be part of what we're doing. It's for everyone. It's intentionally very inclusive and diverse and accessible. So please opt in and be part of what we're doing, or support from a distance if you're not from here. Come to things, you'd be really welcome, and hopefully have a good time and leave feeling inspired and challenged. So yeah, that's where we are.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Luke.
You're really welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to Creative Slurp. I hope it's inspired you to try something new in your business. If you loved it, please take the time to leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. See you soon, and go and chase your biggest creative business dreams. You can do it.